Hello, this is the True Faith Patron Podcast. It's the Proview with Mark, Kobe and Keith Gillespie. This is the first of a four-part special on Keith's career. I don't know how many of you listening to this would have read Keith's autobiography, but we're going to go through quite a lot of what's in there. So if you haven't read it and you like what you're hearing, then I recommend you go out and buy it. Absolute pleasure to be joined by you both. I hope you're both doing well.
All good.
Yep, all good. All good, mate.
Glad to hear it. We'll crack on then, Keith. I guess we'll call this part one, and we may as well start with your arrival at Man United. Obviously, schoolboy forms 91, I believe. Let's just talk about how old you were when you first arrived, you know, what it felt like, your impressions of the lads and your peer group, relationship with Fergie, just anything that you want to go into in a personal one. Obviously, in the book, you give the impression that Robbie Savage is actually a really sound lad. So it'd be interesting to know if you think that his media persona is just all one big act.
The first time I went to Man United, I was 13, and I was quite fortunate the club wanted to sign me then straight away. So I signed schoolboy forms on my 14th birthday then, and then with a guaranteed apprenticeship to move over when I was 16. So I made the move then in July 1991, and you know this was the start of me, you know, trying to make it as a professional footballer. And you know, there's no bigger club than Man United to go and try and achieve that. You know, with a manager like Alex Ferguson, who was, you know, incredible in terms of, you know, bringing us all through. You know, because you know, I was very fortunate that I was part of that class of 92 with you know, some incredible players, boys in there who spent their entire career at Man United. You know, you look at Gary Neville and Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs, Nicky Butt, who, as we know, came to Newcastle also. Rob Savage, as we mentioned. You know, it was just a, you know, incredible group of players that came through at once. And you know, we all sort of got our chances at some stage. But yeah, you know, it was very daunting leaving home. You know, you're sort of thrust into the big bad world, and it's up to you to go and try and you know, nail down a, first of all, you want to get into the youth team, and then obviously impress to try and get into reserve football, and then ultimately first team football. So I was very fortunate that my first season went pretty well. We obviously won the Youth Cup, and into my second season, just after New Year, as a 17-year-old, I made my first team debut. So, you know, the surreal thing for me looking back was, you know, 18 months previous to that, I was still at school, and it was just a, you know, incredible to sort of think back on that. And the game itself, we won 2-0. I managed to put a cross in for the first goal and scored the second. So, you know, as debuts went, it couldn't have gone any better. But yeah, it was a daunting time. You know, and as I mentioned before, I was I think we were all quite fortunate in a way, the class of 92, because we all sort of helped each other on, because we were part of you know, such a special team at the time.
I think just to sort of pause a little bit, I mean, just to sort of go from a Newcastle perspective, Man United, when you joined, I think they may have just won the FA Cup. They may have won the European Cup Winners' Cup around about that time, Keith?
Yeah, I think, the FA Cup was 1990.
Yeah.
That's the one that people talked about, that Mark Robin scored in the third round, and everyone talks about that was the goal that that saved Alex Ferguson's job at Old Trafford. And, you know, lo and behold, look what he goes out to achieve after that. You know, so absolutely incredible. Yeah, and then I think 1991, they beat Barcelona.
That's
in
right.
The final of it was European Cup Winners' Cup then. So, yeah, I just joined just after that in the summer.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because the Fergie had started winning trophies before the class of 92 sort of come to fruition, shall we say. Yeah. But you did also see the likes of Lee Sharp in particular, Russell Beardsmore, Robbins, as you mentioned, Lee Martin, who scored the win in the Cup.
Yeah.
I mean, was that part of a key decision for you joining Man United, based on the fact that you knew you were going to be given a decent opportunity to get the first team, or were you not thinking that far ahead?
No, I don't think you can get too carried away. You know, you're obviously going there to try and eventually make it to the first team. But one thing I think Alex Ferguson set out to do when he joined the club in 1986 was just a complete overhaul of the recruitment of the young players and how he seen that. And, you know, as you mentioned there, he'd already give quite a few players, young players, the chance. You know, you mentioned Lee Martin and Lee Sharp and Ryan Giggs, obviously, as well, Russell Beardsmore. There was quite a few others around that time as well who got a few games as well, but not, you know, too many. But, you know, it was something that, you know, my family trusted me going there because they met Alex Ferguson and they trusted, you know, that if you're good enough, it doesn't matter what age you are. And you only have to look in terms of the squad that came through that class of 92. I mean, how much money did those players save the club in the long term? You know, with, you know, if you were to go out and buy a Paul Scholes or out and buy a Ryan Giggs or a Gary Neville, you know, they saved the club millions. And, you know, that's why it's so important to have a good youth setup where you do have players coming through.
Absolutely. The youth setup element is really interesting. And again, this is something I picked up in your book. Man U, obviously they had young players coming through, but there was also an emphasis on you finishing your school studies and they put you on a BTEC, you said, which obviously, you know, you yourself in the book say that you can't really remember what it was about, but it's the mere fact that they did that. And you know, this is what, 25, almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's quite forward thinking, because I remember, you know, a lot of players would get, you know, schoolboy forms. They'd be kicked out when the schoolboy forms ran out and they'd have nothing to fall back on. And I think, man, you were almost kind of a vanguard in that sense, in that they ensured that their players had a solid grounding in education just in case things didn't work out. And I think there are still a lot of clubs who don't do that now. And I don't know, on reflection, is that something that you look back and think, you know what, that was they were well ahead of their time to a certain extent?
Yeah, well, to be fair, that was something that you had to do. And, you know, we went to college and, you know, there was maybe five or six of us went to one college in Accrington. And then there was the other boys who, let's say, maybe weren't as good academically. We used to say they went to the thick old college. So it was like said, myself, Robbie Savage, you know, Gary Neville, Chris Casper, who went to the one in Accrington. And yeah, it was a BTEC course. As I said in the book, I think it's sort of leisure and tourism or something like that. I've no idea. I passed it in the end, like, but I've no idea how I did, because it was just a bit of a drag, really, the Thursdays when we went there. But, you know, it's one of those where you were actually at college and, you know, there was people, you know, from Man City, apprentices, you know, Blackburn, Oldham, and just all the sort of clubs in that sort of Lancashire area. You know, so as players we would have played against on a Saturday. So yeah, it was sort of a nice release at times, you know, rather than, you know, you train Monday morning, Monday afternoon, same Tuesday, same Wednesday, and then you train Friday morning. So the Thursday, I suppose, broke it up, in terms of looking forward to the game on the Saturday. You know, it'd give you that wee bit of release away from football at times, although there's a lot of times in digs, myself and Robbie Savage shared a room together, and David Beckham, another lad, John O'Kane, would have been just down the road. And in the evenings we were very bored, and, you know, they used to have at the training ground, our youth team manager Eric Harrison would have taken sessions for, you know, younger kids, you know, sort of like a school of excellence type, you know, with Man United. And we would have gone down in the evenings and done training as well with them, because we were that bored in the digs. So it was important at times, you know, because it can get, you know, very boring living in, you know, a digs life. You're on £46.75 a week, and, you know, you played on a Saturday, and I think it was maybe £4 win bonus, and that £4 was crucial. So it was. Ladbrokes seen it as probably more crucial than me. But, But we used to go and to, you know, Salford Snooker Hall. We used to go and play snooker there just to, you know, just for something to do at times, because it can get very, you know, tedious living in digs.
It's fascinating hearing this, to be honest, Keith, because one of the earliest memories I've got is one of my first heroes was Michael O'Neill, who I'm sure you'll be very, very familiar with. When he joined Newcastle back in 1987, part of the condition was he said he wanted to finish his, I think it would have been his A-levels back then.
Yeah.
And they made sure that he was doing his training, and then he was going to the college in Newcastle to finish it off. And all of a sudden, he was fast-tracked to the first team because he was probably head and shoulders above the strikers we had at the time. Lo and behold, he's playing first team football, and people are at college, you know, with a professional footballer in that class. It's just surreal. It just goes to show how much football's changed. But just another quick one before we move on, chaps. The class of 92, obviously, we'll probably speak in more detail, but I always remember, I'm sure Norma will, Newcastle's own version of the class of 91, shall we say. I did an article for True Faith probably about 5 or 6 years ago now, and it was amazing sort of how much focus was on the youth back then, and we don't see it now. But if you think of the caliber of players that Newcastle brought through back then, Keith, you'll be familiar with a lot of them, you know, Stevie Watson, Steve Howie, Robbie Elliott, Lee Clark, and then you had the likes of Alan Thompson, who didn't really make the grade at Newcastle, but had a fantastic career, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it just goes to show how much football's changed. And you know, as we will come to, how much, if you really focus on your academy and your in developing players, how you can get it right.
Absolutely. You know, it's, as I mentioned before, Alex Ferguson, when he came into the club, wanted to start from the bottom upwards, and just get a whole direction on where he wanted to go. And you know, Man United has always been a club that has given youth a chance. And there's some crazy statistic that I forget how many games it is, but there has always been a player who's come through the system for the last, I don't know, 40-odd years who has been named in the first team, you know, squad, which is, you know, it's something crazy, like 4,000 games or something, which is absolutely incredible, you know. So it shows how important, even for a club like Man United, who's got so much resources, you know, it's important to get players, you know, coming through the system. And you know, the as I mentioned before, the class of 92 was incredible. How many of those came through to really make the grade?
Absolutely, and you've got, you know, I mean, I'll digress slightly, but you look at Chelsea now, who had that transfer ban in for a year, ended up bringing through loads of youngsters, and they've really benefited from it. But that's a discussion for another time in terms of the finance that is awash in the Premier League now, which stops you a lot of youngsters coming through. So you come through you were really young when you made your Man U debut, and you obviously impress enough to be kept around the squad. And I guess the next big standout moment had to be the victory over Newcastle, in which you played. And interestingly enough, you mention again that you recall, and I think it might have been with Chris Casper, you recall the atmosphere in the League Cup game, which took place only 3 days earlier, didn't it, before the league match at Old Trafford on the Saturday. So it'd be interesting to hear your recollections of the game at St. James's Park that Man U lost in the League Cup 2-0. And then obviously your recollections of that 2-0 win, where not only did you score, but you had a brilliant game. And I'd be really interested in finding out whether, you know, your life almost changed overnight, because all of a sudden, I mean, obviously I know we don't have the saturation of the internet now, but you're kind of going from a youth team player to a celebrity in a very short space of time. And I wonder if that had any impact on you.
Yeah, I think with the lads who came through class of 92, we pretty much, a lot of us, although we played some reserve team games, we sort of bypassed the reserves because we were, you know, thrust straight into first team squad and stuff. You know, and the game that I played where I made my debut, it was a Monday or a Tuesday night. I think it might maybe a Tuesday night when we won 2-0. Well, the following Saturday, I was playing for the youth team again. You know, so Alex Ferguson, you know, wanted to make sure that he kept your feet on the ground. You know, so that certainly did that. Though, you know, going from scoring at Old Trafford in my debut to playing in front of a few hundred fans at the training ground the following Saturday, certainly did that. But for the remainder of that season, I only had one more appearance. It was in the FA Cup, and I came on a sub, and we won again. So. The following season, I did go out on loan to Wigan, but my debut was against Sheffield Wednesday, and I had a really good game. And then, yeah, I remember the game against Newcastle in the cup, which was, you know, incredible atmosphere up there. And you know, I think we played most of the kids. We had a few players played who, you know, of the sort of established players. Which is obviously important. And I think bar Andy Cole, it was probably Newcastle's strongest side. You know, and we took them to, I think it was 82 minutes before, I think it might have been Big Philippe scored, and then Paul Kitson scored the second, or vice versa. But yeah, it was an incredible atmosphere. You know, I'd never played at St James's before. I'd played against Newcastle in the cup, or sorry, in a friendly at Ibrox that season, in pre-season.
I was there, yes.
Yeah, and John Beresford tells a great story that when he was looking at the team sheet, and he's thinking, oh, I've got Konchelskis this week, and he sees the team sheet, and he sees me playing, he's like, who the heck's he? And he says by the end of the game, he knew enough then. I played against him in a Billy Bingham's testimonial as well, over in Belfast, not long after that. And I had a really, really good game that day. George Best even came on a sub for us, so that was incredible feeling. And Newcastle had a strong side out, and you know, it was Philippe had just signed, and I had a really good game, and then we had the cup game where we lost 2-0. But then it was only 3 days later, the game in the league, and I came on a sub with about 30 minutes to go, and managed to score the second, which was you know, a decent goal. We're cut in from the left and just put it into the bottom corner. But it was something, you know, when later on, when Newcastle, you know, the transfer came about, it was something that with the atmosphere that I experienced that night in the cup game, you know, something I'll never forget, the noise they made. And it was a big, big factor in me, you know, joining the club, because I knew what a special place it was to play. And that was my first time. When we got beaten the cup, so it was a big factor, because I knew how passionate the fans were. I'd already seen it when they played at Old Trafford in their first game, their first season back in the Premiership. And I remember it was a 1-1 draw, and Andy Cole had scored. That was the season, you know, Newcastle came third in the league. And I remember, you know, I was still like an apprentice then, and I remember watching the game, and I remember the fans behind the goals, just the noise they made. And you know, I can't remember who I was sitting beside at that time, but I was just amazed when we were talking about it. So, you know, things, you know, certain things stick in your mind, and that was certainly one of them. How good the atmosphere was, and how good the away fans were at Old Trafford that night.
I think I was at that game in 1993, the 1-1 draw, Keith. Absolutely electric atmosphere from both sets of the port. It was edgy as well, because back then there still was an element of hooliganism to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And one thing I do remember about this is, I don't know whether you recall a gent for Newcastle called Nikos Papavassilou, who played for us for a number of games at the start of that season. And where we were in that corner, his brother, and I believe Papavassilou's wife or girlfriend, was sitting right in front of us. His brother was a spitting double of him with that mop of curly hair. And when Andy Cole scored, I've never seen anyone go as mental as his brother did. He was like, the veins were pumping out of his neck, his eyes were popping out, eyeballs were popping out. And we just jumped on him as if say, well, we're standing with a celebrity here. He's part of us, who's part of his brother. But that was a false dawn because part of us who played about three more games and we've never seen him again, you know. but getting back to, you know, where you come through and really started getting the public eye that game at Old Trafford, we had been unbeaten for 17 games that season. We were on absolute fire. But as you rightly say, Andy Cole was out. And I think, I could be mistaken, but Scott Sellars was injured as well. And he went off injured, one of the two. And to be honest, Keith, that game, thanks to you, mate, we started falling apart.
Yep. And I think at the time, Newcastle were sitting top of the league. I think Man United were maybe second at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was a really important game. And actually, the next game for United after that was Barcelona away, when Barcelona absolutely hammered us 4-0.
Ah, yes.
And I was part of the squad that night, but I wasn't on the bench at all, even because of the foreigner rule.
Yes.
Because, they brought off Ryan Giggs when I came on in the league game against Newcastle. And he probably wasn't fully fit for the next game, but he was one of the, three foreigners that was selected. And that was even a night when we played away in Barcelona where Peter Schmeichel was left out because they had so many foreigners in the squad that Gary Walsh played in goals, and nobody ever thought, you used to always come to the European games, you used to always try and work out who would be playing. Cantona was suspended because of what happened when they played Galatasaray, and he threw the fan across the pitch or whatever it was. But you used to always try and work out, and you go, well, Peter Schmeichel's an absolute cert. You know, he's definitely one of them. And then you try to work out who the others might be, and you thought, well, Giggsy. But then you look around, and you go, well, you've got Kanchelskis, you've got, Cantona when he is fit, you've got Dennis Irwin, you've got Brian McClare, Mark Hughes, Roy Keane. You know, it was incredible the sort of, the foreigners that he had. And, crazy that being from Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, yeah. you were considered a foreigner.
Yeah.
That was the crazy thing about it. And I suppose that's the reason then, because why Alex Ferguson seen the need to go out and get an English striker because of that European rule, and Andy Cole was the one who fitted the bill.
No doubt. And also, I guess it ties into what we were talking about earlier in terms of players from academies coming through. You know, if you've got a rule that stipulates in European competition, you can only have three spaces in the team taken by non-English players, then you probably would. I mean, you would need to bring academy players through regularly in order to maintain some form of challenge in Europe. So what one thing feeds into another, doesn't it? It's interesting you mentioned Eric Cantona there, because it got me thinking about the, I mean, when you were coming through, the personalities in that dressing room at Man United, just absolutely huge. And it got me thinking about Roy Keane's arrival. And obviously Keane has this reputation as being the kind of the big shot, demanding, assertive. And I was wondering, when Keane arrived at Man U, very young, I mean, early 20s, I think he only had one season in the top flight with Forest, really, where he was excellent, obviously. Was he the kind of confident, assertive and demanding person that we see now from the off? Because, I was bearing in mind the fact that dressing room, he was a kid and he was joining hard characters. I mean, real hard characters, Cantona, Ince, Hughes, Schmeichel. What was he like?
Yeah, I always had a great relationship with him. I think he's absolutely brilliant as a pundit to watch because, he just doesn't hold back, and you're going to get, 100% truth from him. He's not going to sit in the fence whatsoever. But yeah, he is coming into to a dressing room, and you've got even Brian Robson is there at the time, Ince as we mentioned, but he was just a fantastic player from the off. You could see, although he was very very young, you could see how annoyed he could get in training if somebody just gave the ball away. And you get players who train, and Mark Hughes is the worst, probably one of the worst trainers I've ever seen. He was so, so bad. Gary Pallister as well. But on a Saturday, you knew what you were going to get from them. But Roy Keane was one of those who just was trained exactly how he played. And you know, the way he came through, you know, show it sort of showed you how good a player he was, because Paul Ince was a top midfielder at that stage, and Alex Ferguson let him go not long after. And Roy Keane was sort of the main man then. But you know, he was just a fantastic character. Well, a player that, you know, you didn't want to be on his team in a five-a-side in training, because you give the ball away, you got an absolute rollicking. But if you were actually against him, you know, he would go through you no bother whatsoever too. So it was one of those. But no, he was a fantastic player. And I mean, going back to when you talked about the young players, you know, it was important to bring them through in terms of that stage because of the European thing. I was really unfortunate because of the eight of us that all signed professional contracts on the same day, seven of them were English, and I was the only, you know, foreigner, so to speak. So they were always involved in those European games where, you know, I never got that sort of chance. So I pretty much missed out then. All the boys, Beckham and Scholes, Nicky Bott, all those, you know, got their chance in the European games.
Just a quick one on Roy Keane, Norman. You may recall when we got knocked out of the FA Cup by Forest in 1991.
I was there.
Yeah, well, Keane played as early as then, mate. He must have come through a lot earlier, because he was the 1990-91 season when Forest got the Cup final. If you remember, Keane was up a height as much as Gascoigne was in the Cup final. Something to do with he couldn't get all his family and friends Cup final tickets, believe it or not. Imagine that, the biggest day of your career, and you're worried about getting your mates in, you know. But a little thing about that, the FA Cup game, when Newcastle were getting, I think we were getting beat 2 or 3-0 at the time, and he took objection to some abuse from Newcastle supporters, so he gave him the V sign, and Brian Clough dragged him off, gave him a clip on the touchline. That's a true story. So he was a worky ticket from a young age. But just allude a little bit to Keith. I mean, obviously you don't have to give too much away, but there was, in Roy Keane's book, he suggests there was a massive drinking culture at Man United at the time. And he also mentions when he first joined Man United, he potentially stopped at an airport hotel.
Yeah.
And he says that a lot of the players used to go there to make the new lads welcome. But it could work both ways. It could have a great night out, but a lot of supporters would get wind of it and go around and try and wind them up and you know, tell them off for drinking when they should be professionals. Basically, were you part of that culture? And you know, what was it like drinking with these absolute superstars, really?
No, I actually wasn't, because you know, I was still a young lad. I was still living in Diggs even when I left the club to join Newcastle. You know, you've got these sort of established stars who, you know, it's such a big area, Manchester, and then you've got players who live, you know, are dotted all about, you know. So I'm stuck in Diggs, not far from the training ground. So you had players who would have gone out with your likes of, you know, Sharpie, Giggsy, you know, and on Saturdays at times would have been out with them. But in terms of drinking cultures, you know, you end up, before that, you know, you had the likes of Brian Robson and Paul McGrath and Norman Whiteside, and you know, their drinking clubs on a Sunday or something used to be absolutely legendary, apparently. But I wasn't party to that, because you know, I was still a young lad living in Diggs. The only time that would have been socialising with the likes of the first team is maybe when we had our Christmas day out. But you know, it's crazy in terms of, you know, the fans thinking that players are not allowed to leave the house and go for a drink. You know, you know, the players were always doing that when the time was right. You know, it wasn't like you were doing it 2 days before a game or a day before a game. You know, some fans think that they sort of, you know, had the right to tell players that they couldn't go for a drink. And you know, everyone's human and needs that release at some stage. And you know, going for a drink and having bonding sessions at times is something that we did at Newcastle, you know, countless times during the sort of 95-96 season, and it brought us all together. And we used to do that maybe every 3 weeks, and it could have been a Thursday night because we weren't playing to the following Monday. It could have been a Monday night, we weren't playing to the following Saturday, but we always did it at the right time. And I suppose we were quite fortunate because, you know, the team was flying high, and you know, the fans aren't so bothered about that. You know, but if the team aren't doing as well, you know, I'm sure there would have been a lot more to say. But I think it was important that every single player had to go. The coaching staff all went, the medical staff, the kit man. The only people who didn't go was Kevin Keegan, Arthur Cox and Terry McDermott. So we had absolutely everybody. And yeah, you know, we used to always go for food first. We used to go to Uno's down in the Quayside. And
yeah.
And then if you wanted to go home after that, you know, you're talking Peter Beardsley there as well, who didn't drink, but you know, as I say, everybody was there. But if you wanted to go home after that, you know, a lot of boys went home. The sort of younger ones, you know, would have stayed out longer and would have ended up in, you know, maybe Martha's Bar, and then obviously down the Quayside to Julie's, which was obviously the regular haunt. But you know, there was no problem again with it then, you know, as long as you knew you were doing it at the right time. And I always remember later in the season, about March time, we'd arranged this night out, and I think it was for a Thursday night. We weren't planning to follow Monday, and Kevin just, you know, he'd known about it all season that we did it, you know, because nothing got past Kevin Keegan, and certainly in Newcastle, you know, everybody sort of knew what you were up to. You know, it is, you know, like a goldfish bowl at times, but all of a sudden he just stopped it and says he didn't want us doing it anymore. So maybe that's the reason we didn't follow through and win the league in the end.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. It's like Romario, isn't it? Romario would basically say, you know, I need to go clubbing until 5 a.m. in order to play football at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. I mean, you're right. It's all about bonding, and it's in any walk of life. Any walk of life, when you work in close proximity with people, you do perform better when you bond. And, you know, football's no different. And obviously now, I guess, players are kind of, especially at the top level, micromanaged to within an inch of their life. The media trained to say exactly the right thing. And it's almost to the detriment of the real personalities coming through. And that's why, you know, you get certain players like, and I speak about him quite a lot, but Mikel Antonio at West Ham, you feel like you're actually seeing him when he's interviewed, the real person, as opposed to this kind of micromanaged player. And that's what it was like back then. You know, I think as fans as well, because you would see players out in Newcastle drinking and doing the things that you did in your spare time, you would feel that kind of bond. You felt close at the players. Whereas now, I think young kids at the age of 11, 12, 13, or teenagers, young adults, that closeness, I guess it just doesn't, it might not be the case anymore, because it's almost like footballers at the top level now are completely untouchable. 1996, you walk into Julie's on a Monday night and there's half the Newcastle first team squad.
I think with Kevin Keegan, you know, he was pretty much of the fact that, you know, this is the fans' club. That's why he encouraged, you know, open training sessions all the time, and, you know, 6,500 people coming down in you know, when you're training pre-season and school holidays. And, you know, the place was just really thriving, and you did get that, you know, up close and personal with the players, whereas now you can't get near them. It's a bit like I was talking today at a thing, and you know, I spoke about, you know, playing for Northern Ireland, and with the journalists, you know, with Northern Ireland, we had a great relationship with the journalists with Northern Ireland. And after the game, if we're playing away, and be it Ukraine, wherever it is, we used to go out with the journalists for a drink. And we tried to sort of, you know, they stayed in the same hotel as us, and you got up, you got friendly with them, and you knew that there was never going to be any stitching up, you know, because, you know, we all know what journalists can be like, but, you know, you get on a good relationship with them. Whereas we were sort of like thinking, you know, the press just don't get that chance with the England players. There's not a chance that they would be anywhere near them the way we are with the press of Northern Ireland. And that was the same sort of thing with Newcastle, because the fans, you know, got to see, you know, players outside of football. Whereas, you know, they just don't get that chance now to get up close and personal with them.
Speaking of Northern Ireland, Keith, it was around about this time you had already made your debut, is that right? Was it Portugal at home?
Yeah, 1994.
Yeah, so you'd already made your Ireland debut. You were scoring against Newcastle, and you scored your, was it your first goal? And I've seen it. I remember it happening at the time, but I've watched it back. And what a bloody brilliant first goal for your country, mate. Talk us through it.
Yes, it was my second cap. You know, my first cap was amazing. You know, 7th of September 1994. And on the 7th of September 2005, you know, 11 years later, we actually, that was the day we beat England. You know, so it's a strange sort of, you know, that it occurs like that. But yeah, my second cap, my first cap, you know, we lost against Portugal.
Yeah.
2-1. I know that was a really good Portuguese side with the likes of Figo and Rui Costa and Paulo Sousa, you know, really, really good side. We lost them 2-1. But, you know, that entire campaign, we went through unbeaten away from home. You know, incredible for a little country like Northern Ireland to actually do that. But, yep, the second minute in Austria, you know, a big stadium, big set of Olympic stadium in Austria, and the ball sort of landed. Ian Dowie flicked it over his shoulder, and I just caught it on the volley from the corner of the box, and it rifled into the top corner. And I remember coming back to Man United, and Alex Ferguson, you know, talking about the goal, and he said, "Is any chance of you doing that for us?" And then it was maybe 2 weeks later, three weeks later, where I scored the goal against Newcastle. And I ended up both goals were on match of the day for goal of the month. Unfortunately, I didn't win it, but it was nice to sort of get two out of the 10 in the same month.
Fantastic.
I tell you what, Keith, it's great that we've moved on to Northern Ireland, because I want to give it a kind of brief discussion before we move to Newcastle. And it's great that you mentioned the Austria game there, because obviously the goal was fantastic. And I remember I was at Gated College at the time, so I would have been 94, September 17. Uh-huh. And I remember buying the Daily Mirror newspaper and the report being in there and a picture of the game, you know, that you striking the ball. And I'm almost certain that would have been the first time that I'd read of you in the obvious George Best comparison. And this is what I'd like to hear a little on is, how did that feel at the time, given you were so young? And obviously Best is an integral part of Northern Irish football and wider society history. He's a hugely important cultural figure in Northern Ireland. And I guess, is that something that you enjoyed? Is it something that weighed on you? Is it something you even thought about?
No, the thing about going to Man United and from Northern Ireland, I mean, there's always been huge links with Northern Ireland and Man United in terms of players. And you go back to Harry Gregg, one of the Busby Babes, and then George Best and Sammy McIlroy, Norman Whiteside, you know. So there's been a lot of players who've come from Northern Ireland and played for Man United. And I think, you know, even Norman Whiteside got labelled the next George Best, and, you know, totally different players. Maybe the fact that I was sort of a similar type of player to what George was in terms of, you know, being a winger, liking to dribble with it. You know, I obviously got the comparisons, you know, as well. So I think that's just something that inevitably happens to anybody who comes from Northern Ireland and goes across the water to Man United. It did become my nickname. A lot of people still call me it. It's my nickname now is sort of Bestie, and it was actually Chris Sutton who christened me it when I went to Blackburn. I've been known as Bestie by most people ever since. But I think it's probably, you know, I probably tried to emulate him off the pitch more than I did on the pitch. you know, it's... you know, looking back, you know, George Best, one of the greatest players that the game has ever seen. And it's a big reason why I became a Man United fan, because my dad became a Man United fan because of the George Best link, being from Northern Ireland and going to Man United. So, you know, as I mentioned before, playing in a testimonial with him, although he was slightly intoxicated when he came on as sub that day, but, you know, just incredible to, you know, that just... the sort of aura that he possessed, you know, in the dressing room and all. And, you know, it's like God walking into the dressing room when George Best walks in. And, you know, just, I know he had his demons, but I think everybody just loved loved George Best, the player. You know, incredible how good he actually was.
Absolutely, and still obviously one of the greatest quotes ever with wasting his money. And it's that quote, isn't it? What does he say? Is it in the hotel when the bloke went in the hotel asks him where did it all go wrong?
Yeah.
And is he with Miss World? And
yes. And I think all the money's on the bed because they've been to the casino and he's just sort of thrown it up in the air. You know, that was it. That was the quote, where did it all go wrong?
I don't doubt you were in similar situations, mate. But
I was. There was definitely no Miss World.
we'll come to that stage of your book a little bit later, I would imagine.
All right.
And also, if anyone listening, we're not going to go into it here, but Keith mentioned Chris Sutton briefly there, and it's worth reading the book alone just for the slating that Chris Sutton gets in it in the Blackburn season. I won't go any further, but it pleased me greatly to read your words on Chris Sutton. And anyways, well, we'll move on then to the move itself. Just talk us through how it, you know, the genesis of it, how it transpired, and you know, I guess how it felt when you realised that you were moving at a time when, you know, you had started making waves. Ultimately, the club of your dreams, the club that you supported as a boy, and, you know, as you've said before, one of the biggest clubs in the world, if not the biggest.
Yeah, just after New Year, we had a league game against Coventry at Old Trafford, and I played in it. We won 3-0. And so, you know, I was making, you know, good strides in terms of, you know, playing games for the first team. But I still had Andrei Kanchelskis in front of me, who was a fantastic player. And our following game was Sheffield United away in the cup, and Andrei had flu. There was a few other people sort of struggling as well. So I remember going to the game thinking, well, I have a great chance of playing here tonight again. So the team was announced, subs were announced, and I wasn't involved. And we got to the ground, and Alex Ferguson, you know, just pulled me aside, and he just the only thing he said was, "Look, I'm in for this English striker at Newcastle. You know, no names mentioned, but he obviously, you know, didn't take a brain surgeon to work out. It was Andy Cole. He said, but the only way the deal is going to happen is if you go the other way. And he sort of explained that because of, you know, being from Northern Ireland, you know, it was only after later on in my life that I realised that Kevin Keegan had, you know, made an inquiry for me long before this, long before any talk of Andy Cole was mentioned, and Alex Ferguson, you know, turned that down. It was one of them where I'm going to the game thinking I have a chance of playing, and then all of a sudden, within a conversation with Alex Ferguson, I'm thinking about leaving the club. But he said to me, you know, watch the game, have a think, and just tell me what you want to do. But, you know, there was no pressure on me whatsoever. You know, I could have turned the move down, but I remember sitting beside Ben Thornley, and Alex Ferguson had told me not to say anything. So, you know, I didn't actually, you know, mention, but I just, you know, quite cutely turned the conversation with Ben round to Newcastle, talking about Newcastle and, you know, what he made of them and that. And, you know, he would have just been unbeknown to why I was sort of asking the questions. But, you know, he had nothing but good to say about Newcastle. So I'd made up my mind, because, you know, I always go back to that game when I remember the fans with that 1-1 game when Andy Cole scored. And, you know, I thought to myself that, you know, this is a great opportunity for me to go to a club, a Premier League club, managed by, you know, incredible person in Kevin Keegan. So, you know, after the game, I went to the manager and says, yeah, but I would like to go and talk to Newcastle. I remember before that I spoke to Brian McClair, Brian Robson, spoke to Steve Bruce. Steve Bruce in particular was one who said, oh, you need to go do it. You know, he was slightly envious, you know, in a way, although he's at Man United, but he is a Geordie, you know, and he was slightly envious that I was getting the chance to go and play for Newcastle. So what happened then, we went to a hotel in Sheffield. The rest of the players got on the coach and went home, and myself and Alex Ferguson got a car to take us to a hotel where Freddie Fletcher, Freddie Shepherd and Kevin Keegan, who had been at the game, were waiting. So we got to the hotel, and you know, by then it's around about midnight, and you know, this is pre-mobile phone, so you know, on the phone in the hotel, Alex Ferguson said to me, "Get your mum on the phone." So rang my mum, and she came on the phone. She was, you know, maybe a little bit worried that the phone was ringing sort of so late at night. Alex Ferguson came on the phone, explained the situation. She trusted him. She said, as long as Keith's happy, I'm happy. But Alex Ferguson then mentioned that, and my mom obviously knew that I'd never had an agent, but, you know, could he act as my agent in the negotiations? So she was very much happy with that. So I spoke to Kevin Keegan, and honestly, it was literally 30 seconds, and, you know, it only took 10 seconds of those 30 to sell the club to me. You know, that is what a character he actually is, how incredible, how he can sort of do that. And I know with Rob Lee, Rob Lee turned down Middlesbrough because he thought it was too far north, but Kevin Keegan talked him into going to Newcastle. You know, so he's incredible, incredible person. We then went in and had the negotiations. Alex Ferguson told me to say absolutely nothing. And at the time, we'd all signed contracts. We were on £250 a week. We weren't on big money. And Alex Ferguson was, you know, a great believer in that, you know, we were still making our way in the game. And until you became that sort of regular first teamer and you're playing every week, that, you know, you don't go on to the higher end money. So as I said, we were all on £250 a week, the eight of us that had signed professional forms. But I remember sitting there, and I sort of, you know, a shy 19-year-old, and I'm sort of head down sitting at this round table, and Alex Ferguson's got a notepad and pen and all out, and he's writing things down, and all of a sudden he turned around and he says, "Look, well, Keith's on £600 a week at the minute. We want you to double it." And I sort of, when I heard this, I sort of, you know, looked up, so I did, and he sort of gave me this look across the table as if to say, "Don't you say a word here." And Newcastle agreed to it straight away, you know, so that's how easy the negotiations went. You know, Alex Ferguson obviously told a little white lie, but, you know, not that I was bothered about that, because he was obviously just trying to do his best for me. And, you know, I went up the next day and signed, you know, and that was the same day then evening that Kevin Keegan, everyone will remember him, on the steps. And I think, you know, some people who maybe weren't that aware of me, you know, were maybe wondering, was I a sort of direct replacement for Andy Cole? You know, and that was obviously never going to be. Kevin Keegan had a long-term plan, and that's when it became apparent in the summer, you know, that he had his sights obviously in Les Ferdinand, and brought Les in, and we know how good Les was. You know, so I think with the way managers are, you know, there's nobody like Kevin Keegan, because I don't know of another manager in the game who would have come out and stood on steps talking to fans and appeasing them, really, because by the end of the conversation, it was a case of Kevin Keegan saying, "You need to give me the opportunity to take this club forward, and this is the way I see it." And by the end of it, the fans agreed with him. They trusted him, and you just have to see what happened then, because this was January time. You know, the following season, we were nearly Premiership champions. So, you know, he was right in what he said. But it's incredible how much faith, you know, the Newcastle public had in Kevin Keegan as a manager, and they had every right to do so, because, you know, as I mentioned before, he made it that it was the fans' club, and how important the fans were to the club.
It's fascinating hearing that, Keith, because at the time, I mean, I was roughly Norman's age, 16, 17, absolutely devastated to lose Andy Cole, absolutely devastated. But when you look at the facts and you look at that period of time, there was rumours Cole wasn't happy. There was rumours that his application wasn't right in training. There was rumours of bust-ups for Kevin Keegan, which, let's be honest, you don't do. And when you look at the actual statistics, we had won two games in 10 since that defeat at Old Trafford. We had dropped from first to fifth. We'd been knocked out of Europe. We'd been knocked out of the League Cup at home to Manchester City. And Cole essentially hadn't scored in around about 9 or 10 games. So you understand that Keegan probably looked at it and probably thought, look, I need to start building for next season and we'll see how we get on this season. You, from a supporter's perspective, it was probably the first major sort of issues Kevin Keegan had as manager at Newcastle, especially when he had, as you rightly say, he had to go on the Millburn stand steps and explain his actions. But again, as you rightly say, we had drew with it home to Blackburn in the cup, Cole's last game before the transfer, and the replay. I remember being down there, and there was a talk of Andy Cole had actually travelled over to Ewood Park to say his farewells to the players because he didn't have a chance to do
he actually did, because I was sat on the bench. I wasn't involved that night, but I was there for that game against Blackburn.
Yeah,
I think it was Mark Hollinger got the winner.
That's right. Yeah.
But I remember being in the hotel and Andy Cole coming into the hotel to say, you know, cheerio to the boys. So yeah, it was you know, a great night that night, because nobody sort of thought with us, with Newcastle having sold Andy Cole, that, you know, we had a chance of beating Blackburn that night. And, you know, that was the season Blackburn went on to actually win the Premiership, so they were flying high as well.
Well, this is it. It's fascinating, because Keegan's obviously put a hell of a lot of faith into you and your ability. Because let's be honest, Ruel Fox was the number one right hand side. We'll call him a winger stroke midfielder. Uh-huh. But you know, at that point, you had left Man United, and Andrea Kanchelskis was in front of you, and you were coming to Newcastle, and Ruel Fox was. It, from my point of view, he was in front of you.
Yeah.
Were you confident in your own ability? Did you think you stood a better chance at Newcastle than at Man United at that point?
I think you have to be confident in your own ability. You know, I didn't think, you know, because £7 million back then was you know, such a lot of money. You know, it was a British transfer record, and, you know, to be involved in that transfer was a huge thing. But it was quite easy for me, because nobody... You know, I was sort of classed as the make weight in the Dale, so nobody was expecting probably too much. So the whole pressure was probably on Andy Cole, you know, rather than myself. And it meant then that I was able to, you know, quite fortunately hit the ground running. I remember my home debut for against Wimbledon, and I remember it was the first time I got the ball. It was about a minute or so gone, and I just, you know, knocked it out of my feet and just, you know, legged it. And that was the first time the sort of fans had really seen, you know, that I had a bit of pace about me and how direct I was. So, you know, I think that was important for me, that, you know, with it being such a big move in terms of, you know, the size of the transfer and you know, Newcastle losing Andy Cole, I think it was very important for me to make sure that I hit the ground running. And as you mentioned, Ruel Fox was there. Ruel moved to the left wing. And on, you know, many occasions, and I played on the right, so I think Ruel Fox was happy enough to do that. And to be fair, he didn't really last too much longer into the next season before he was away to Tottenham.
That's right, and I tell you what, that is an absolutely fantastic place to leave this part, because we can move on to Newcastle career in part two. So thank you, gents. What I will say is, the night that Keegan was on the steps, one of my overriding and overwhelming memories is the turtleneck that he was wearing. And I just thought, there aren't many people in the world who can pull off a turtleneck.
Yeah, a beige one too.
Beautiful, wasn't it? Absolutely. Yep. I mean, that should be, if there's ever a proper Newcastle United museum, that ought to be in there, in a glass case.
Then again, Norman, before we do finish, I have got a nice picture of Keith in the hotel wearing a Fetchy jumper as well, which looked about 20 times too big for him, I'll be honest.
That was the style back then.
So I don't know whether to release that, but we could blackmail him, Norman, later on.
I don't want to say it.
That's the picture that I'm using for this podcast, without a shadow of a doubt. Gentlemen, thank you ever so much. That was fascinating. Listeners, hope you've enjoyed it. We will definitely be doing a part two. We're hopefully going to put out four parts. If I had it my way, this would be a 50-parter because, as I say, having read the book, there is so much to discuss. And one story in particular with Gary Flitcroft had me rolling around on the floor. We'll hopefully get to that at some point. But as I say, thank you, listeners. Thank you, lads. And we will speak to you very shortly. Cheers.